Hello everyone. Today I will be reviewing the movie Titanic, released in 1997. With me I have my friend Noel, who is a big movie fan but also a very, very well-informed Titanic. I want to call you historian. Is that okay?
Yeah, sure. You can call me a Titanic buff if you want.
Yeah. So when did you become fascinated with, you know, the Titanic?
Oh man, this is something I enjoy telling people, because it's just, you know, I feel like Titanic is something that has been very big in my heart since childhood. It's been something I've been very passionate about for a long time. I first began to become fascinated with the Titanic when I was in the third grade. So I want to say that was 1999 going to 2000, man, I'm old.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I was in the third grade at the time, and it actually started with the movie. It was from my parents. My parents were watching the movie, and they let me watch it along with them. I believe it was on HBO at the time. That's what they were watching on. And from that point on, that's how my obsession with the Titanic began. Like, it took off from watching the movie that we are about to talk about. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I remember ever since, after I watched the movie, you know, I was just hooked right there and there. Like, now, like, I just couldn't get enough of Titanic after I watched the movie. Like, I remember every time there was one of those book fairs at school, I was always looking out for Titanic books. I was always hooked on the Discovery Channel, checking, like, keeping my eye out for, like, the next Titanic documentary, because it seems like after the movie came out, there were so many of them. Mm-hmm. So I was just, you know, head over heels for Titanic. So that's really how it all began for me.
Yeah, that sounds pretty, you know, it sounds pretty cool. I remember when I first watched Titanic, I was, like, 6 years old, and it was in, like, one of those Spanish-dubbed TV channels, because I didn't have cable when I was really little. So, like, you know, watching that movie at first, I was like, oh, my goodness. And, I don't remember who it was that told me that it happened in real life. So, you know, when you're a kid and you're watching this movie, you're like, oh, my God, so this, all of this happened, like, you know, even the Rose and Jack story, which was not true.
Right.
But did you ever think it was real?
I think so, because I think my mom and dad, even my uncle, because my uncle Rudy was, like, also kind of into Titanic. In fact, it's funny because he, shortly after, like, I became a big fan of Titanic, my uncle Rudy gave me, and I still have it to this day, it's in my office, I'm pretty sure you've seen it plenty of times, he gave me that replica newspaper from the Boston Daily Globe about the Titanic sinking, because he knew I was into Titanic so much, and he was interested himself. And I believe he told me, it was him along with my parents that told me, oh yeah, you know, like, this is a true story, like, there really was a Titanic that sank. And like I said, you know, after I watched the movie, I was always watching, like, anytime there's a Titanic documentary, like on the History Channel or Discovery Channel, I was always watching it. So that's where I really, you know, it just really hit me, like, wow, this is a real historical event that happened so many years before I was born. And I think that's what also made me a lot more fascinated in the story of Titanic, mm-hmm. just because of, you know, just how long ago this happened. It was a completely different time period where things in society was so much different mm-hmm. than, you know, the world around me at the time.
Yeah, and, you know, before, you know, we move forward with the movie, this was the month of the Titanic sinking, the real one, and
right.
And so, you know, it is a disaster movie, but it's also like those realistic disaster movies, so I wanted to make sure that we gave Titanic the recognition, you know, kind of like a memorial service. You know,
yeah, I agree with you.
Yeah, yeah,
you know, for those of you who are going to be listening, you know, we meant to get this out 2 weeks ago, which was the anniversary of the sinking, but, you know, mm-hmm. shit happens, so
yeah, it was the microphone.
Yeah, it's okay. But as we're recording this, it is April 30th, so it is the last day of April, which means it's the last day of Titanic Memorial Month. So at least we're still, you know, we're still putting this out there, and this is, think of this as our way of, you know, giving recognition to the Titanic, not just the ship itself, but the people that were involved in this tragedy. Not just the ones who did not make it, but even the ones who did make it, you know, because mm-hmm. everybody was affected, whether you survived or not, everybody was affected by this tragedy. Mm-hmm. So I think this is, you know, this, we just want to, you know, give them some, you know, we want to pay our respects.
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, the movie that was released in 1997, you know, I feel like it had such great actors that I feel like it. This is what made Leonardo DiCaprio and Kate Winslet who they are. And I feel like they became kind of like that movie, I mean, that on-screen couple that you wanted, you know, for them to be together in real life. Kind of like Jim and Pam from The Office.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so, you know, they were 23 years old when this movie, you know, when they were playing these characters.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. They were young.
And, you know, I know that Rose was supposed to be, like, 17 or 18, right?
Yeah, she's supposed to be 17 in the story.
Yeah. And, you know, we have this, like, plot of her and, you know, Jack, her mom, and then her fiancé, Cal Hockley. Billy Zane, dude. Like, Billy Zane.
Yeah, Billy Zane.
Yeah, so, you know, the main characters are Leonardo DiCaprio, Kate Winslet, and Billy Zane, along with Jonathan Hyde, who plays Bruce Ismay, who's also that badass butler in Little Richard, Richie Rich. Oh, my goodness.
He was also the reason why I remember Jonathan Hyde is because of Titanic, and he was also the dad and the hunter in Jumanji.
Exactly. So, you know, Jonathan Hyde, man, wonderful. I mean, he's a good 90s icon. I feel like he was a 90s, too.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Great actor. We also have
Victor Garber
as Andrews, yes. And, you know, we'll go with the cast a little more, a little later on. But, you know, the plot, this specific plot, we know that it wasn't real, like, We know that there was no Jack or Rose.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know,
although it's funny because there actually was a Jay Dawson on board the Titanic, but he was one of the crew members. He was, I believe he was a stoker, so he worked in the boiler room, and his grave site can be found in Halifax along with a lot of the other Titanic victims.
Mm-hmm.
And the funny thing is, his gravestone is marked Jay Dawson.
Uh-huh.
So a lot of people think it's Jack Dawson, the fictional character, which I always laugh because it's like, guys, Leo's character was fake.
Mm-hmm.
This Jay Dawson, this was a real person, but not the Leonardo DiCaprio character.
Yeah, really, and actually his name was Joseph Dawson, and he was a hair barber.
Okay, yeah, that's
fine. And he was from Dublin, Ireland. He was born in September 1818. Joseph Dawson, who was later buried at Fairview Lawn Cemetery in Nova Scotia. And did you know that his gravestone is actually the most visited cemetery?
That's right, it is. Because, mm-hmm. again, people think it's the grave of Jack Dawson, the character.
It's not Leo DiCaprio, guys. No, yeah, that's the thing, too, but... You know, James Cameron wrote this story, so it's like, big props to him. You know, he probably created one of the most iconic love stories, you know, that we saw. And to this day, I think that this movie is probably considered the Beatles of cinema.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, everybody's going to know about the Titanic.
Right. It's so iconic. Like, this movie to me is up there with like the likes of films like Citizen Kane, mm-hmm. and Gone with the Wind. You know, everybody knows this movie.
Mm-hmm. And you know, I wanted to mention some of the scenes that occurred, you know, while filming this movie. So according, you know, to some trivia, it said that the naked scene where Leo draws Kate, or Jack draws Rose, that was the first scene that they actually shot. Yeah, so imagine, like, just barely knowing, you know, your co-star, you know, your co-worker or whatever. It's like, oh yeah, you know, our senior, we're gonna get naked, nice to meet you. Or I'm gonna get naked, nice to meet you.
Well, here's another piece of trivia about that scene. Every time we saw a close-up of the hands doing the drawing, those were not Leo's hands. Those were actually James Cameron's hands.
Mm-hmm.
So he really wasn't, so Leonardo DiCaprio really wasn't doing the drawing. It was James Cameron. But you wouldn't know that because, you know,
it's a close-up. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's a close-up of the hands. You don't see the face and, you know, clever editing.
I know, the editing, you know, it was just so realistic, and I feel like, I mean, not realistic, but like just very emotional. And, you know, like I said, props to James Cameron for literally dedicating himself into writing this movie. I feel like, you know, he also spent 5 years actually researching the Titanic.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
How long have you had researching the Titanic?
Oh, man, well, like I said, it all began in 99.
It's been a while.
it's a very long time. Yeah, mm-hmm. It's a very long time. But yeah, Cameron has done his research, and even to this day, Cameron is still, he's still passionate about the Titanic, you know, because even after production and filming wrapped, you know, he went on to do a couple more expeditions to the wreck of the Titanic. Like, one of them, he did an expedition to the wreck in 2001 for the documentary Ghosts of the Abyss, which is good, by the way. So so Cameron has a lot of passion for, it's not just the case of he just wanted to make a movie about the Titanic with a fictional love story. Like, no, he really poured his heart and soul to this thing. In fact, I think just the work that Cameron did really, I can tell a lot of historians, you know, really appreciate the work that Cameron did with this film. And you know, even though I'm not like a legit historian or anything, but I for one, you know, I applaud his work and give him a ton of respect for his contributions to the history of Titanic.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, while it was cold in April, I'm pretty sure, like, here in the East Coast, or not here, like, in the East Coast, this film was shot in Rosarito. And so, I've been to Ensenada, like, it's the same, it's close, it's, they're close to each other, and I can tell you that, even in July, that water was pretty cold. So,
yeah, in fact, I've been to Rosarito a few times before, and I've actually even passed by the Fox Studios where they filmed Titanic. Unfortunately, the massive ship set is no longer there. They dismantled it. But the studio is still there. So, like, when my family and I used to go to Rosarito on vacation, the condo that we would always stay at, when we would travel there, we would always pass by the Fox Studios, and I would always be amazed. So I'm looking at it, I'm like, wow, that's where Titanic was filmed.
Yeah.
I'm like picturing, imagine this is 1996, 1997, and this big, massive, full-scale replica of the Titanic is right there on the coastline. That must have been an impressive sight.
Yeah, of course. And, you know, I mean, if people took photos, I would love to see that, you know, just because it's a great, you know, it's kind of like a great a part of history and, you know, movie making, where like you have these actors who are still pretty recognizable, you know. I think that it's funny now that I'm reading this, you know, moving with the acting scenes, that after finding out that she had to be naked in front of Leo DiCaprio, Kate Winslet decided to break the ice, and when they first met, she flashed him. Yeah, and you know what's also interesting is that Kate Winslet is Welsh. I think she's Welsh, isn't she? Or is she English?
I think she's English.
Okay, and so, you know, a lot of, actually, in Hollywood, there's a lot of body double, kind of like, oh, you know, it's not your body that's getting naked, it's a double. But she was like, no, I can, right. You know, she actually was very, she didn't care. She's like, no, I'll flash myself. It's fine. So, you know, props to her, man.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, to this day, like, you know, she continued the legacy of acting, and that's just wonderful. And, you know, even though I think she's also recognized as one of the shadiest actresses in a movie, because I feel like people haven't forgiven her for that whole door scene, you know, of having enough room.
Oh, man. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Even the Mythbusters had to be called in to put that one to rest.
Oh, my gosh. I remember it's like, there was enough room. And, you know, it's like, I feel like there's a good reason why there wasn't enough. I mean, even though there was, like, I don't think the weight of both of them could, like, handle.
I think even James Cameron on that episode of Mythbusters where they sought to prove whether they could have both survived. I think James Cameron himself said, you know, yeah, I admit they could have both survived, but the reason why I only have one survive is because then if they would have both survived, then the story would not have been so dramatic. Which
exactly.
I understand because, like, you know, like if both of them would have survived, you know, it's like, okay, yeah, the typical fairy tale ending, but Cameron was going for more of a tragedy here, so I understand why he did it.
And speaking of tragedies, you know, Rose in this movie, she was marrying a big money guy, Cal, who's played by Billy Zane. Yes. So I feel...
someone who's a lot... In story, supposed to be a lot older than her. Because remember, in the story, she's 17, and Cal is, like, in his 30s.
Yeah. And I feel like, you know, when you're grown up and you're watching this movie, I feel like it's not like I appreciate Cal, but just Billy Zane's acting as a villain is just understandable. And I feel like he did such a great job in trying to, like, get his prey. It's like, you're not going to leave me for him whatsoever. Like, remember when he paid one of the security or one of, like, the sailors to, like, let him inside a lifeboat? Yeah, Murdoch. That was him.
Yeah, Murdoch.
Yeah, when he paid him and then, like, it was finally his chance to get on the lifeboat and he still didn't go because he wanted Rose.
Right.
And so, you know, this plot is just obviously very, you know, it could fall for, like, a Disney movie, I feel. It can. I feel like, you know.
It's funny you mention that because, you know, this movie was distributed by, not only by Paramount, but also by 20th Century Fox.
Mm-hmm.
Well, 20th Century Fox is now owned by Disney, so I guess you can consider Titanic a Disney film, and I guess you can consider Rose a Disney princess.
Yes, I think you can. I mean, it's plausible. There have been more tragic Disney princesses, I feel. Yeah. No, but,
Cal is a Disney villain, and Jack is a Disney prince.
Yeah. And her mom, dude, like, let's talk about her mom, man. So Ruth Whitaker, you know, I think it's also that when you're grown up and you're watching this movie, because obviously when you're, like, 15 watching this movie, you don't really understand a lot of, like, psychological you know, points of the movie. But now with her mom, you know, so we learned that her family, like, her dad died and left a huge debt, and they have literally nothing to fall for. So the mom's reason for her to marry Cal is because he has money and they will, you know, they will arrive to America rich,
right?
And so, you know, when she's talking to her about how, like, she doesn't, you know, does she want to see her as a seamstress again? And it's, like, one of those things that, yes, the mother is kind of selfish. She's super selfish. But, you know, you understand that, like, I feel bad for Rose mostly because, like I said, you know, she is 17 years old and she has literally nothing, you know, to say because she's a child. And so, you know, her mom even tells her, you know, nothing's ever easy for us. We're women.
Right, exactly. Mm-hmm. I was actually about to mention that. It's such a good line because, you know, it's true because it's, if anything, this is also, you have to remember, this movie is very well a social commentary about what early 1900s, 19-teens was like, you know, for at that time. You know, because remember, this was before, you know, women's suffrage and, you know, the movement for, you know, women having the right to vote and all mm-hmm. that. So during this time period, women did not have a lot of, they didn't really have any rights. And even when you see the way Cal treats Rose, she's treated like property, because at that time, women were pretty much considered property to the men.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, it's very...
The way he wants to control her and everything.
Yeah, it's just super... When you know, like, the times back then, you, like... And especially, like, with immigration, which I will talk about, you know, later on. But I feel like everything in that movie shows you the side of, like, the rich, the poor, the, you know, the people that are working, the people who created something. And, you know, I feel like the characters... I always felt bad when, like... You know, we're going to mention it later, but when Andrews dies, you know, spoiler alert. But, you know, with him dying, and, you know, this was his creation. And one of the scenes that got to me a lot was when, you know, she's saying, hey, like, let's go. You know, the ship is sinking. And he's like, you know, I wish I could have built you a safer boat or safer ship. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that was kind of like very, it got to you, because it's like, you know, you created this magnificent ship, and for it to like sink, it's like you let yourself down, and it's just probably the worst feeling you can have, you know, because people died, and mostly, you know, men who you feel for the women that went to America alone, because like you even mentioned it, this was before women's rights, this was before women, you know, most women worked, because I know a lot of them, you know, they didn't have anything to look up for, and you know, they lost her husband, so they literally went to America empty-handed.
Yeah, that's right. That's why the Armes Carpathia, the ship that rescued the survivors, it was known as the Ship of Widows, because the majority of those survivors on board the Carpathia had just lost their husbands in the sinking.
Oh man, yeah, I think you did tell me that it was named the Ship of Widows. Oh my goodness. Yeah, no. You feel for that. And, you know, that shady guy, Bruce Ismay, you know, we talked about, obviously, wonderful actor, you know, he's played by Jonathan Hyde. But, dude, he is, like, the greed of the movie. He, like, wants more. He's like, oh, no, we have to make the headlines that we were the fastest ship, not only the biggest one. And, you know, when he is saving himself is what literally, you know, it's like he felt like, I don't want to die here, you know, I'm too important to die. And like he was the one character that didn't even like try to save others. I feel like it was just about him.
Yeah, and you know what, I was going to mention that a lot later on, but since you were bringing it up, I'll go ahead and mention it now. Mm-hmm. That act, you know, just by him getting in the lifeboat and saving himself, in real life, that destroyed Ismay's reputation, because as soon as the press got word that Ismay survived, he was immediately the first to be vilified, because him surviving was seen as an act of cowardice. And not just that, you're talking about hundreds, 1,500 people, men, women, and children that were under his care, because this is his ship, who lost their lives while he saved himself. In fact, when you think about it, the trinity of the most important people on that ship, Captain Smith, Thomas Andrews, and Bruce Ismay, of those three, only one survived, while the other two went down with their ship.
Yeah, and isn't it a saying, you know, like, the captain, you know, goes down with a sinking ship? Mm-hmm. It's like a saying, and, you know,
I believe it's actually the Titanic disaster, that whole phrase, you know, the captain goes down with the ship, kind of originated.
And, you know, this just makes me a little interested in, like, researching about that Bruce Ismay incident. You know, it's a good thing you mentioned it, because, yes, he got what he deserved at the end. You know, nobody admired him. You know, nobody cared that he had, you know, millions of dollars or how much he was worth back then. The fact that, you know, a lot of families died, especially the third class, who definitely had little chance of surviving. And, you know, those ships that were, you know, third class, that were mostly immigrants from Europe.
Right.
And, you know, a lot of them Irish, a lot of them, you know, trying to find a better life in America. And even like also the work crew underneath that were, you know, keeping the ship going. And, you know, and, you know, it's just those scenes that you think about a lot when you're older and you're watching this. Oh, sorry. And you're watching this movie. Because when you're watching this movie, obviously some people watch it because they love the story between Rose and Jack. They love the, you know, the historical, I mean, the realistic history of it. But I watch it for everything. I feel like the immigration at that time, you know, immigrants were seen as like still the lower class, still the people that, you know, you're beggars, you're wanting a better life. So you have to kind of like, yeah. Work for it.
Yeah, in fact, one documentary said it best. It's actually a really good documentary. It's called, what's it called? Titanic, The Complete Story. And it's a two-part. It aired on A&E back in the early 90s. So this was before the movie came out. But and one of the commentators who's being interviewed for the documentary said it best. In third class, you were treated like cattle. Mm-hmm. You were treated well, like good cattle compared to other ships at the time. But still, you were still treated like cattle.
Yeah. And, you know, speaking of that, I visited Queenstown, which was the last departure in Ireland before the Titanic sailed to America. And they even told us that actually this was the first time that third class, you know, I mean, the people that were considered third class saw working water and electricity in their bunks. So in a way, they were kind of upgraded from the lifestyle that they had, which was actually pretty interesting to know about, because when you see this movie, you know, you see how, you know, they have a little bit of room for, like, you know, they're bunked with three other people, you know, they don't have the fancy dinners, the fancy, you know, churches. It's like they have to create their own kind of way of, you know, spending time on the ship, whereas first class people like Cal and Rose and Ismay, you know, they had everything pretty much. And you know, but it was wonderful. I mean, it felt really great for me to also see that side, the realistic side of like Queenstown, where it showed us like how the rooms were. And it was pretty real. Like, they actually send you to like this replica of like the rooms, which was pretty cool.
Yeah, and I know exactly how that feels, because I've been to the Titanic exhibit in Las Vegas twice, and inside the exhibit, they also have replicas of some of the rooms. Like, they have a replica of the grand staircase, which is beautiful, it's phenomenal. Yeah. They have a replica of a first class stateroom, and they have a replica of a third class cabin, complete with a hallway and everything. And it's really interesting, because, you know, you have to understand, for a lot of these immigrants, you know, this was the very first time that they have seen stuff like a working toilet,
yes,
a bathtub. A lot of this stuff was new to them. Now, when you compare the living quarters, or not the living quarters, when you compare the cabins of third class to second and first class, they're obviously very plain and Spartan compared to those cabins, which are very lavish. But to a third class passenger, they didn't care. They didn't care that their cabins were plain, because all that mattered was, hell, this is so much better than what I'm used to living. I take this plain white bunk and room. It's small, but I take this any day over than what I'm used to living.
Yeah, because, you know, we know Europe is a very condensed, you know, continent, and, you know, the fact that people saw America as like this big opportunity country, you know, where freedom is prevalent. And, you know, the fact that, you know, this was also a big part of the movie that is, it's not really ignored, but it's like when you study history, you finally see, oh my goodness, this was an immigrant ship, basically. And like, you see all like the big money makers that were there, and the big names that, you know, to them it was just like, oh, this is just business work, I'm on vacation. But, you know, you saw that other side, which was, you know, immigration. And Jack Dawson, you know, in the movie, he was like that free-spirited American boy. So I think you can consider him the first hippie. Yeah, he was just like, yeah, I just kind of live day by day. You know, I don't really care. And, you know, I'm just, I'm so glad that the character of Kathy Bates, Molly, so glad that Molly was, oh my goodness, I loved her in that movie. I feel like she's just so,
I agree, I love her too.
She's so under, you know, rated, you know, she was one of the first people that kind of like understood Jack. She wasn't like those big, you know, old money, because she was considered new money, but those big old money, you know, people that didn't really, that didn't have a clue of who was on the ship, but she had kind of like this motherly care for Jack, which I really liked.
Yeah, she becomes something like a, like kind of like a mentor kind of figure to Jack, like, so like somebody who takes, like, she's like somebody who takes him under her wing in ways.
Yeah, when she tells him, you're going to the snake pit. I love that scene. Yeah,
I know, me too.
I agree.
And that's the thing I love about Molly Brown, because, you know, she absolutely identifies with Jack, because, you know, this is a woman who is also trying to climb up the social ladder, because, you know, like you just said, you know, she came from nothing, and then her husband strikes it rich, so now just like that, she's become a millionaire, and she's trying to climb up that social ladder, which a lot of the others, such as Rose's mom, who were born into privilege, frown upon that, because for them, you have to be born into it. You don't just make it on your own out of with dumb luck or whatever. You gotta be born into it. So that's why Rose's mom, like, looks down upon Molly Brown, because of how she got her fortune.
Yeah, and but, you know, you have to also think about, you know, Ruth was that way, but she was hiding. Like, she didn't tell anyone, oh, you know, if my daughter doesn't marry this rich guy, I will be on the streets. Like, she was projecting her insecurity onto, like, Molly and thinking, oh, you know, she's new money, she doesn't matter. But then it's like when you find out her backstory, you're like, oh, aha, we knew something was up with you. Yeah. And, you know, obviously, you know, to her, Rose going with this Jack guy would just ruin all her plans. And, you know, definitely besides, I think, the iceberg, Billy Zane, Cal was seen as the villain because, you know, he's kind of like in the way of this romance story, and he's selfish. He just wants, you know, his fortune and his kids, his inheritance and whatnot. And, you know, what's really interesting is, you know, how in the beginning of the movie, we have these, these kind of like, the character that Bill Paxton played, that they were looking for this diamond.
Yes, rest in peace, Bill Paxton.
I know, rest in peace, great actor. I know that I talked about him in the Twister review, but that's how the movie begins. You know, they're looking for the diamond that, you know, we let her find out that Cal gave Rose.
Right.
And so, you know, it's just funny how, you know, I mean, I'll talk about this later, but the fact that they are looking for a diamond that they talked about how they kind of found it through the books, right? Because it was claimed that the last person that purchased that diamond was Cal.
Right.
It was a Hockley guy that was also in the Titanic. And the fact that, you know, well, the 90s compared to the 1910, it was what, like 80 years? Since the Titanic sank. And so, you know, we have this, like, old lady in the drawing. That's the first time we see the drawing. And, you know, we have this story thanks to old Rose, pretty much.
Right. Old Rose is played by Gloria Stewart, who is an actress mainly during Hollywood's golden age, like during the 30s and the 40s and all that.
Mm-hmm. And did you know that they said, I mean, in the movie Titanic, she was supposed to be 101, but in real life, she was 86.
Right.
And she didn't like that.
Right.
Yeah, really? She didn't like it. She's like, I didn't think it was a pleasure, you know, to be playing 101 years old when I was actually 86. Yeah.
It's funny because they actually, yeah, she was old at the time because, again, she was in her 80s, but that was a lot of, like, her appearance in that movie, a lot of that was all makeup. Again, this is a character that's supposed to be 101, so they had to do a lot of makeup on her to give her the appearance of a 100-year-old woman.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought that was very interesting.
Yeah.
Also, interesting fact about Gloria Stewart, because like I said, she was active mainly in Hollywood's golden era. She plays the love interest in The Invisible Man, opposite Claude Rains.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, that was made in the 30s.
Oh, wow. Yeah, no, and Rose, you know, was also became an actress, you know. I want to say it was the Silent Hill generation, right?
Probably around that generation, yeah. Because, you know, that rant that Lewis, Mr. Bodine, goes on, because, of course, he doesn't buy Rose's story that she was on the Titanic and that the drawing was of her. So, you know, he's like explained to Bill Paxton, you know, oh, yeah, I did the background check on this woman going all the way back to the 20s.
Yeah.
So that was basically like the silent era.
But yeah.
Not that far off.
Oh, yeah, no, it was still, like, because it was actually, the sinking of the Titanic happened way before the Great Depression, too. And so, you know.
This was 1912.
Yeah.
The stock market crashed in 1929.
And so, you know, it's interesting how they mentioned that Cal actually made it alive and he inherited whatever his millions, but then the crash of 1929 ruined him and he ended up shooting himself. And so, you know, we know Cal is, you know, he's a big part of the movie, too, because, you know, of the way that he is against Rose and Jack. And so, you know, but just knowing about those facts, because a lot of millionaires actually, they were ruined completely by the stock, by the crash of the market in 29. And, you know, very good facts to also know about this. It's like, you kind of. You know, I feel like towards the end when Cal saves himself, he kind of like, he's not the Ismay kind where like he saved only himself. Like, he was actually pretty clever. Like, getting that little girl.
Oh, yeah.
He was pretty clever. Mm-hmm. And I feel like Cal himself had like, you know, he was always chasing this woman, you know, that didn't want him. But he was, I feel like in deep inside, Cal knew that he wasn't good enough. I feel like he wasn't good enough. Like, he knew that he wasn't good enough. Like, Rose found somebody that actually loved her and wasn't in, like, you know, he had that, like, knowledge, I feel. And when he finally gave up, one of my favorite scenes in this movie was when he's laughing and he's talking to his, like, his, what does Rose call him? His cop?
His valet.
Yeah, when he's saying that, like, you know, he put the diamond in the coat, and then he put the coat on her.
Mm-hmm.
So this is how we found out that, you know, Rose had the diamond with her.
Right, because it was thought, because according to the story, because the diamond had never been, because here's something you got to understand, because later on at the end of the movie, we find out that Rose, when she's on board the Carpathia, and the crew is getting all the numbers of the survivors, when one of the crew members approaches Rose to get her name so they can put it on the list of survivors, she doesn't give them her real name, which is Rose DeWuplicator. Instead, she goes by Rose Dawson.
Mm-hmm.
So because knowing that she boarded Titanic as Rose DeWuplicator, who was never on the list of survivors, it was assumed that Rose DeWuplicator was one of the casualties of the Titanic, and because Bill Paxton explained that he had filed an insurance claim on the diamond, that's why they conclude that, okay, Rose DeWuplicator died in the sinking of Titanic, and the heart of the ocean, which is the necklace, was never found. So therefore, that diamond went down with the ship.
Yeah. And so, you know, I feel like this was a good. How did you feel that Rose didn't give the diamond to the crew? Instead, she like threw it down the ocean.
You know, it's interesting. I mean, it's somewhat kind of it's kind of a little bit of a sweet moment. I mean, I don't know. I mean, the interesting thing is there was actually a deleted scene where. Rose's granddaughter, Lizzie, is talking to Bill Paxton somewhere on the ship. And so suddenly they see Rose, like, on the fantail of the Kelvish, which is the research ship they're on. They see her standing on the rail of the fantail, and they're freaked out because they're like, oh my gosh, what's she doing? Is she going to jump off again? So they approach her, and she brings out the diamond, and she shows it to them, and Bill Paxton's like, you had the diamond this entire time, which you can't believe, because, you know, he's done all this research, and all this time Rose had it. And I think the reason why she never gave it up or anything, because it's been a while since I've watched this deleted scene, but I guess she wanted to prove that she can make it in life without having to rely on Cal's money, I think. And the deleted scene ends where, before she tosses it into the ocean, just like when we get in the final cut, Bill Paxton asks if he can hold it just once, which he does. She lets him hold it just once, and then he kind of realizes, you know, like, this diamond really isn't, it's not worth it. And he lets her toss it into the sea. Like, it's really interesting. Like, if you you have to watch the deleted scenes, because they're interesting. Just knowing that this stuff was cut out of the movie.
That is actually really interesting, and you know, now that you told me about it, I will watch it, because I always thought, you know, like, even in the beginning, she said, oh, you know, I hated wearing that thing, it was so heavy. You know, to her, you know, she was always this like rich girl, but, you know, to the modern, I guess, historians nowadays, I feel like it is worth something because it's part of history. However, like, it's understandable, you know, like, I think kind of saying that way worse things happened, you know, regarding this diamond, you know, it's just the history of people. And, you know, imagine, I mean, it's kind of funny that, you know, one of the richest men in that ship, Astor, he dies. And so, you know, you have this kind of like metaphor that we all die, you know, not the metaphor, but kind of like ironic that, you know, these poor passengers, the rich people, they died the same way. Yeah. And they all died in the same ship, you know.
Yeah, this tragedy, when you think about it, did not discriminate. It didn't matter if you were rich or male or female. If you were on board the ship as it was going down and you were not lucky enough to get into a lifeboat, you know, you were screwed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm pretty sure there was bribing going on. I'm pretty sure that, you know,
it's possible. I mean, we can't say 100% that there was bribing going on. I know some people, some of the more richer passengers that survived were accused. In fact, I think the Duff Gordons were accused of bribing an officer to get because they made it into a lifeboat and survived the scene. Sir Cosmo and Lady Duff Gordon, and I think they were accused of bribing an officer. But again, we really don't know. It's just one of those legends that surround, and trust me, there is a ton of legends that surround the Titanic.
Yeah.
Because, you know, there's just, you know, this happened over 100 years ago, and, you know, just like with any kind of tragedy, there's facts, but then there's also going to be, you know, stuff that's often romanticized and, you know, like, kind of like fables around it. And that's one of them, you know, that there might have been passengers that bribed the officers for a spot in the lifeboat.
Mm-hmm.
And I love how at the end, you know, when they're trying to, the crew's desperately trying to hook up one of the collapsible boats onto the davits.
Yeah.
And Murdoch's trying to keep the crowd back, and Cal just approaches them and goes, oh, we had a deal, damn it. And I love how he just takes out the money that he put into his pocket and just throws it back at him. He has this great line. He says, your money can't save you, nor they can save me.
Yeah, and your money can't save... Yeah, exactly. That was one of the scenes that, you know, I feel like Murdoch was one of, like, the officers that we get exposed to the most, because he's the one kind of handling Cal. He's the one handling all these people. And even from the beginning, we see him, like, with the captain. So he was kind of, like, the captain's second hand. And, you know, even those people, like, it's funny how during that scene when, you know, it's really cold and, you know, that was, after Rose kind of like escapes from her first class cabin, and then we see the two, I guess, kind of like watchers, the Night Watchers. Game of Thrones reference. Anyway, the two Night Watchers that were, you know, that first kind of see the iceberg, and then they tell...
The lookouts.
Yeah, the lookouts. And, you know, that scene where, like, they're telling the crew members who have to tell, the captain who have to tell, you know, all these, you know, how the information passed down, up, down to, like, the people that were in the machinery, you know? And, you know, just those scenes kind of gave you that, like, historical, you know, knowledge of like how things worked back then, because I mean, I'm not sure how modern ships work, but the fact that it was coal, right? Was that the engine that was keeping the Titanic?
Yeah. This was the early, this was a steamship, you know, mm-hmm. Early 1900s, 19-teens, so, you know, this is before, you know, like these electrical powered ships. I don't really know much about how ships are powered these days, but, you know, back then it was all through coal. Mm-hmm. That's why they had boilers, because you have to, you know, shove all this coal into the furnaces, mm-hmm. and when they burn, it creates steam, and that's what powers the engine, which keeps the ship going.
Yeah, and, you know, actually, really interesting fact is that they said, now I don't know if you know about this, that if the Titanic were to hit the iceberg like front, it wouldn't have sunk.
Yeah, I've heard this theory before, and to be honest, I used to believe that it was true, but I don't anymore, because I'm a follower of the Titanic Honor and Glory team. This is a group that's actually, they're in development. They're trying to develop a video game called Titanic Honor and Glory. They're still in development, but they are getting a lot of their facts straight up, and they work with a lot of historical consultants and historians and all that.
Mm-hmm.
And they have touched on this theory that, oh, if the Titanic would have hit the berg head on, it would survive. And what I gather is, based off of what I've heard from them, no, it actually would have been a lot worse, because what would have happened is it would have hit the iceberg with so much force. What would have happened is it would have severely damaged the watertight bulkheads and caused the watertight doors to be jammed. Therefore, that would have probably made it a lot worse. The ship would have most likely sunk a lot faster, and it would have capsized. Which means you would not have been able to use a lot of those lifeboats. So even though, yeah, like people say, yeah, if it would have hit head on, it would have survived. I don't think so. I think it would have been worse if it hit head on.
And, you know, just the communication of, like, you know, even in the movie they mentioned that they informed other, you know, sailing ships that they were in danger, and it took them like a day, right? Or 2 days.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Because according to, like, Disney wants to get there. He wants to get there a day early, because this goes back to, you know, these like legends that surround the ship. One of the common legends is that Disney wanted to beat the record that was made by Titanic's older sister ship, Olympic, because mm-hmm. Olympic had made a successful crossing 1 year before Titanic. So of course the idea is, well, you know, these ships have to one-up each other. So, okay, this is what we did. This is how we did with Olympic. Now Titanic has to do better.
Mm-hmm. I think that Ismay could be considered a villain. I think he could be. Yeah, because, you know, greed, man. You know, you're already this big moneymaker who, you know, you already have the biggest ship. It's like one day at a time, dude. Like, you know, it was mentioned in the movie that this ship was unsinkable, and, like, I think that was Cal's saying throughout the movie, oh, this ship is unsinkable, and this and that,
yeah,
and then...
God himself can't even sink the ship.
Yeah, and then Andrews had to tell him, well, no, it's an iron ship, it's gonna sink, like he told Rose that. And also, one of the most devious thing that Cal said when the ship was sinking was that, you know, he finds out that Jack is an artist, and we know that he mentioned, I mean, Picasso's mentioned in the movie. And, you know, when Rose is putting up Picasso's art, you know, Cal says, oh, he'll never money to, like, amount to anything. And then he says, good thing these drawings were cheap. But, yes, but also, you know, when he finds out that Jack is an artist, you know, he says something super snarky at Rose when he was like, oh, you know, in the morning that drawing will be worth a lot more because, you know, Jack is going to be a dead artist and we know that artists are more famous when they die.
Right.
So that was something that you're like, holy shit, like, what a devil.
This guy's such a dick.
I know.
And again, you really have to give Billy Zane his props because he did such a great job on owning the role that you legitimately hate him.
Yeah, of course. But it's like, you don't know what to hate. You want to hate the iceberg and you want to hate him at the same time. Because, you know, Jack made it out of the sinking ship, for sure. But then Kate Winslet becomes a villain because there was room in that door for, like, both of them. So it's like, you find new villains every year. And I feel like, you know, I'm glad that myth was just debunked. I'm glad that, you know, people kind of realized that even though there was room, the weight of the two people were not gonna suffice, you know. You're like sinking it more with more weight, and I feel like, yeah, I feel like, you know, remember that meme that happened with Leo DiCaprio in Inception when he woke up in the ocean? Do you remember that? It's like, oh, now we know what happened to Jack. He ended up in the sea, you know. It's like, it's just one of those things that were just kind of like everything.
There were two of those Leonardo DiCaprio memes. That was that one, and there was, I believe I told you about it. There was the other one about how Leo actually survived. Jack actually survived the sinking, and when he survived, he ended up taking on a new identity. He became Jay Gatsby.
Oh my goodness! Yes, I remember that one too. You know, this is what I'm saying. Like, this movie will never die because I feel like everything that came out of it was just super iconic. And I feel like this movie, even though that story of Jack and Rose wasn't real, you know, you kind of have to see into, like, everything that was, you know, which, like, immigration, these big money makers. Actually, a really interesting fact was that J.P. Morgan was supposed to go on this ship.
Right. Yeah. He was supposed to go.
Yeah, and he had...
Bruce Ismay was, in a way, the owner, because, you know, he was the president and the chairman of the White Star Line, which was the shipping company that the Titanic sailed for. J.P. Morgan was the ultimate boss, because the White Star Line was actually a part of the bigger picture, which was, because during this time period in the 1910s, J.P. Morgan decided, you know what, because J.P. Morgan was already a well-known mogul in America, you know, he was involved in so much, and mm-hmm. So in this time period, he decides, you know what, I'm going to get involved in shipping. So he establishes something called the International Mercantile Marine, mm-hmm. which was comprised of a bunch of different shipping lines, and one of them was the White Star Line. So really, J.P. Morgan was the big boss. Like, he really was the true owner of the Titanic. And yeah, he was supposed to set sail on the maiden voyage, but at the last minute had to cancel.
Yeah, this, you know, Chase Bank donated to the Titanic.
And it's interesting because who knows? Like, it makes you wonder, if J.P. Morgan had sailed on Titanic, what would have happened to him? Would he have gone down with the ship like so many other of the well-known millionaires?
Well, if he was buddy-buddy with Bruce Ismay, I'm pretty sure that they would have both selfishly gotten down. I mean, it's like, come with me, bro. It's like, I'm pretty sure they would have both hooked it up with each other. Like, hey, like, let's hook it up. Like, let's just go. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Because, you know...
Mm-hmm.
Oh, no, it's just one of those things that, you know, obviously... I mean, Rockefeller, J.P. Morgan... I think, who else was, during that time, oh my god, I remember, it was Morgan, Rockefeller, Henry Ford, yeah, you know.
Yeah, I'm like, because I'm thinking about that History Channel documentary series, The Men Who Built America.
I know. And like I said, you know, this movie has all the components of like history, and I feel like it's just, it's like I said, you, it's hard to hate this movie. You just can't.
Yeah, like, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Even though I know, unfortunately, some people who hate the movie. I'm not kidding.
Yeah, I mean, I'm pretty sure people were like, oh, you know, it's just too overrated. I mean, it kind of is, but, you know, actually, the funny thing is that Matthew McConaughey was supposed to play Jack. The studios wanted Matthew McConaughey, but James Cameron wanted Leo DiCaprio, and also, actually, River Phoenix, who was Joaquin Phoenix's brother, rest in peace, he was supposed to play Jack, but he died, actually, like, a couple of years before. And Jack, I mean, Leo DiCaprio was already, like, in age. Because, actually, funny thing is that Leo DiCaprio was the same age that River Phoenix was when he died, I believe. Yeah. And so that's pretty, you know, pretty tragic, you know, his death. But, obviously, you know, Leo DiCaprio, after this movie, I mean, he played Romeo and Romeo and Juliet. You know, we're still seeing him in movies, and I feel like he is... Him, you know, Brad Pitt, all these 90s heartthrobs. And then, you know, I'm just, it's just really cool that, you know, I'm really glad that, you know, movies like these, you can watch over and over again and you never get tired of it.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. I never get tired of watching Titanic. You know, whenever, every now and then, it will be on TV. And, you know, if there's nothing else good on TV to watch, and I'm like, fuck it, I'm gonna watch Titanic. Mm-hmm. Because it's such a good movie. A little bit of history that I wanted to touch upon, because I know you brought up, you know, Ismay surviving, you know, he got on the lifeboat. Mm-hmm. I'm gonna go ahead and just mention it now. So, you know, when the ship is sinking, and, you know, the captain, the crew, they already know the fate of the ship, they know it's gonna sink, it's not surviving. Obviously, the orders are given to uncover the lifeboats and to start evacuating people. Now, here's the thing that has always interested me, because on the two sides of the ship are different officers. On the starboard side of the ship, you have Officer Murdoch, who was on duty when the ship struck the iceberg.
Mm-hmm.
He's in charge of lowering the lifeboats on the starboard side, which have all the odd numbers. On the port side is Second Officer Charles Lightoller, who was the second, he was the senior most officer to survive the sinking.
Mm-hmm.
He's in charge of the lifeboats on the port side, which had all the even numbers.
Yeah. Both
Murdoch and Lightoller interpret the women and children first rule differently.
Yeah.
Because everybody knows women and children first. Mm-hmm. Lightoller, or actually, I'll start with Murdoch. Murdoch was women and children first. So he was more lenient. So what that meant was, first the women and children or the lifeboats. If there aren't any women and children left, then he will allow the men to get on board the lifeboats.
Yeah.
So if you were a male passenger on the starboard side of the ship, then you had a good chance of surviving because Murdoch was more relaxed. Lightoller, on the other hand, on the port side, was more strict. He interpreted as women and children only. So no men were allowed to board a lifeboat.
Yeah.
The only men that were allowed to get on the lifeboat were crew, because, of course, they were in charge of, you know, manning the boats, rowing and stuff. I think there was only one male passenger, a lifeboater, allowed to get on the lifeboat. But other than that, did not allow any men to get on the lifeboat. It was only women and children. Now, this plays into a big part of the movie towards the end when the ship is reaching its final moments, because, like you mentioned, Ismay gets on board one of the last lifeboats to leave the ship.
Mm-hmm.
So after there are no more women and children left, and Ismay sees that there's no one left, he gets on the boat, and Murdoch just, like, has this moment of, like, what the hell? You know,
yeah.
Like, at least what I think is going on. It's like, what are you doing? But, straight away, so he just
because he also has to deal. Yeah, go on.
Just before Ismay got on the boat, because keep in mind, that was also the same boat that Cal and his valet could have had a spot in, because, you know, Murdoch remembers, you know, he's looking at Cal, he's like, well, he's like looking at him like, well, aren't you going to get in? I'm allowing men. There are no more women and children. Men can get on board. Mm-hmm. And of course, Cal's emotions get the better of him. So that's why he says, you know what? I'm going to go after Rose. So after that, that's when Ismay then boards the boat.
Exactly, and you know, Murdoch already had to deal with so much shit. Imagine all the crap you have to deal with trying to like get people to like get on the lifeboats, and you know that you're gonna be like one of the last ones because you're the one that's making sure people are getting in, and it's like, you know, you're the last one to even care for yourself because you know you have all this already, and then not only that, you know, you have all these big money makers who don't care about anyone else. They just non-hesitantly get on the ship, I mean on the little boat, and that's what we see with like that moment with Ismay, who like we see him feel guilty, but then you know he's just like, I just don't want to die, like, you know. And to me, and it, even then we have this moment with Andrews, who tells Murdoch like, why are there only like two people, you know, in this boat, like there's more people can fit in. And then he's like, we know
we're
What do you mean?
The second officer.
Yeah. Oh, yes. Yeah, and, you know, he tells them, we tested these boats with 70 men in Belfast. Like, a lot of people fit in them. And, you know...
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not, and that's not in real life, because, you know, a lot of the lifeboats actually were not even half full. A lot of them had plenty of empty seats. And it was a combination of all sorts of things. You know, yeah, there was the ignorance of the officers because they really felt, oh, well, you know, we have all these people in the boat. It's going to come apart and everybody's going to drown. But also, a lot of it was also on the passengers themselves because, you know, you are on this big ship. It's warm and cozy inside and it's freezing cold. And not just that. Remember, people really do believe that the ship is truly unsinkable. Nothing can happen. And you have an officer telling you, hey, you got to leave the ship. We're going to put you in the small boat.
Mm-hmm.
As a passenger, you have to be thinking, you want me to get in this small wooden boat in the freezing cold in the middle of the ocean when I can be inside the safe ship, warm and comfortable in my cabin?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, no thanks. I'm going back inside. So a lot of it was also the ignorance and the stubbornness of the passengers why a lot of these boats were not even filled to capacity.
Kind of reminds you of what we're going through right now, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, kind of reminds you of the times right now. I feel like people like their own comfort. They like, you know, whatever.
That's another thing I like, not just about the movie, but just the Titanic story, the real life story in general, because I feel like, you know, it's an allegory. Like, a lot of things can be related to the Titanic disaster, including the pandemic that we're currently experiencing.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, I just kind of want to, like, mention just everything great that, you know, this movie really portrayed. I mean, it portrayed a fictional story, but, you know, it gave us a good sense of, like, something realistic. And that's why I wanted to kind of bring it into this month, you know, before it ends, about the Titanic's history. And, you know, I'm really glad that you joined. Actually, the last thing that I do want to mention is one of the survivors, Melvina Dean, was asked if she would like to attend the premiere, but she refused, stating that watching A Night to Remember, which was released in 1958, was painful enough. So, really fun fact.
Right. Mm-hmm. You know, like, I talked to you about A Night to Remember plenty of times before. You know, like, I mentioned how before James Cameron's movie, A Night to Remember was the definitive Titanic movie. In fact, in a way, A Night to Remember was what the James Cameron film is today. It was like that, but in 1958. And yeah, because of how realistic it was, there were survivors who were still alive at the time. They just refused to watch the movie because it was so realistic. It just brought back all that trauma that they experienced.
Yeah, and you know,
that Melvina Dean did not want to see James Cameron's Titanic.
Oh, of course. You know, it's like, dude, like, I love this. I don't want to see it, you know. Especially, I feel like the 1997 version was just, obviously, the effects of movies were way better than, like, in the 50s, and I feel like watching this would have probably just, oh, man, it would have probably hit even harder just because of how it was filmed.
Yeah, exactly. The way it was filmed, but also because, you know, compared to 1958, a lot more was known about how the ship went down. Like, for one, we now knew that the ship did break in half.
Yeah.
It went down, because in 1958, in the next to remember, the ship is depicted going down in one piece. Back then, the breakup was dismissed as just a myth, even though there were plenty of survivors who said it broke in half, but they were always shot down.
And yeah.
The belief was, no, it went down in one piece. But when the wreck was discovered in 85, then that's when it was confirmed, oh yeah, the ship broke in half as it sank. And so we finally got to see that in 97 with James Cameron's film, because now we knew that's what happened.
Yeah. And, you know, it's great effects, you know, great acting, you know, one of the most memorable movies that we watched probably. And, you know, I feel like the legacy of it will just continue on and on, because, you know, like I said, this is the Beatles of the movies. You know, people are interested in, and, you know, like, you are interested in the history. And, you know, I wanted to thank you for, you know, being part of reviewing this movie with me. You know, I feel like it's one of my favorite movies, and it's one of the most realistic disaster movies, because, like I said, even though Rose and Jack didn't exist in that way, the story of the Titanic is real. And I wanted to thank you once again for joining, because I know that you know. Thank you so much, Noel. All right. And so this ends the podcast for the review for Titanic 1997, along with my friend Noel, who is a big Titanic encyclopedia. So if you guys have questions, make sure to ask him, because he will probably know. All right, well, goodbye.